The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And so it was Thursday night when Liverpool clinched their inevitable title after Manchester City's eighth defeat of the season. But what made it inevitable? Is it all Jurgen Klopp, his coterie of backroom staff, the players, the owners? Or as Barney Ronnie suggested, is it because no other football team has the right people in all the right places? We'll give Liverpool the praise and analysis they deserve. We'll also ask if anyone is really surprised that some fans went and celebrated. You are welcome to yell, "What about the beaches?" while we do. There's the FA Cup quarterfinals as Harry Maguire denies all of us a Tim Krul penalty shootout. We'll round up the Premier League games and the Championship, Leeds taking a big step towards promotion. All that, a bit of Europe, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Greg Bukowski, Guardian journalist, Liverpool fan. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Max.
Ceylon Andy Hickman from Football Beyond Borders, Liverpool fan. Ceylon, how are you doing?
Very, very well, thanks, Max.
The Guardian's Merseyside football correspondent, Andy Hunter. Hey, Andy.
Good morning.
And for balance, Barry Glendenning.
Yeah, I was hoping we might get through today without mentioning Liverpool's title win, but this is beginning to look increasingly unlikely.
Barry, do you have Liverpool fatigue yet?
No, not at all. Congratulations to them. I mean, it was inevitable, and I think I'm just glad they wrapped it up quickly.
Greg, we've obviously talked to you a lot, and football is about emotions as well. So, like, before we get analytical in any way, how are you feeling about it? Because it was obviously, we knew it was going to happen, but did you still have that moment on Thursday night?
Weirdly, in the build-up to it, I think the Crystal Palace result helped massively, because it was like watching the pre-lockdown Liverpool again, and I got excited about that. But even on the Thursday, up until half-time, it didn't kind of hit me, and suddenly at half-time, it just hit me that, you know, Jesus, we're going to win the league. And I had to leave the house. Like, I, the kids were going to bed and stuff. And I just thought, I've got to go. So I just said to my wife exactly that, I've got to go. She said, where? I've just got to go. So I left the house, and I went and bought two bottles of champagne in a corner shop on my bike. And I went and met a few people I know from the Shillelagh, which Baz knows about, a pub in Stoke Newington where a lot of kind of expat Scousers and Liverpool fans go. And we had a socially distant celebration in Clissold Park, and we cleared up after ourselves, Barry, I'd like you to know.
Good. I'm delighted to hear it. Was John Power from the Lads there?
He was there, yeah.
Excellent.
And we had a very nice time, and then I got back and regretted it the next morning.
Ceylon, also a Liverpool fan, and you have the benefit of being young. So this is the first Liverpool title that you've ever witnessed, and finally a chance for older Liverpool fans to stop telling you what it's like to feel the emotion of winning a title.
I think that's exactly it. I think that really hit me on Thursday night. Was I've grown up my whole life and had mum, dad, uncles, grandparents tell me what it was like. They were so involved back in the 80s, and that was always just like an inherited nostalgia for me, and the closest thing I ever had to that kind of growing up has been the Champions League and Istanbul. And I knew that was special, but the speciality, I guess, in supporting Liverpool for me was never about how good the football was, really. It was always about, you know, it's the history, it's the culture, it's the politics, it's the fans, the ground, the songs. And I guess the weird thing now is it's also the impeccable football. And I think for me, this whole, since Thursday night, has just reminded me of kind of the transcendental power of football, in that, like, it's just provided a pure source of escapism during all of, like, I've forgotten that, you know, we're in a pandemic and in lockdown, because football is just, it's just provided that pure joy and connection to your friends and families. And my family don't live in this country, so I couldn't watch it with them, but I was on FaceTime to my mum and dad straight away and just couldn't believe it. But yeah, it's been a very emotional few days, as you said.
Andy, you've covered Liverpool for a long time. You've written a lot over the weekend. I hope you didn't wait until full time in the Chelsea City game to write it all. what's your overriding takeaway of what they've achieved this season?
I think it's monumental, and I think it's brought home just how it's more important than the Champions League to Liverpool fans, this, which, you know, it's a strange thing to say when you see the emotion that surrounded Madrid last year and the reception that the fans, the team got on when they came back. But I think it's more powerful, a more monumental achievement. I think it's, yeah, and I think the people having to celebrate in strange ways is as complicated things. But I think even despite that, you get a sense of how much it means to everybody. I think on Thursday night, I had to, thankfully I didn't write everything on Thursday night, but I did have to do Klopp's quotes after the game. And just seeing him on Sky break down in tears and kind of cut his interview short, and the players as well, kind of, it brought it home how much it meant to all of them. And, you know, all this nonsense about where they win it, how they win it, it doesn't matter, they won it. And, you know, there's been no better champion that I can remember.
30 years, Barry, and only, well, I think it's 13 or 14 trophies in that time. It's an enormous drought for any football fan, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, people have been making fun of Liverpool fans talking about 30 years of hurt, but it is the league title that means so much to them. And after they won the last one under Kenny Dalglish, if you had said it would be another 30 years before they won one again, people would have laughed at you. You know, I remember growing up, just Liverpool swept all before them when I was a kid, and the team with Kenny Dalglish, Graeme Souness, Ian Rush was just phenomenal. You know, Kenny Dalglish was my favourite player when I was a kid, by a mile. Just he was so good, and his total delight, childish delight on his face anytime he scored a goal, and he scored lots of them, was something that still sticks in my mind to this day, because he has a reputation for being quite a dour man. He's well liked, but he does have that, I suppose, possibly because he's Scottish and it's in their DNA. But to think it would be that long again before Liverpool won a title, it was just, you know, you would have had someone committed for suggesting it.
And I guess it's about expectations, isn't it? You know, I joke about a drought of 30 years. Obviously, there are a lot of football fans. It's, you know, the number of trophies they've won in the last 30 years is more than sort of most of the professional football teams in the UK put together. But it's about expectation, Greg. I wonder, have your expectations changed in these 30 years or not? Or every year you go, should get the title this year?
No, it's been a really weird experience in that throughout, I mean, those people talk about 30 years of hurt, and it's not been that, because obviously there's been the European Cup win, there's been FA Cup wins, there's been very close title challenges at times. And I think that's the thing about where Liverpool was and what it's come back to. It used to be this consistent winning machine, and it's come back to that under Klopp now. But between then, it's been a club that's been about big moments and emotional moments. And there's almost a paradox that it's taken a manager who, I've got to say, when Klopp came in, I thought, is he too emotional for Liverpool? Because he's already, you know, Liverpool as a club is emotional. Are we just going to have more of these big European nights and then, you know, away defeats at Crystal Palace or whoever, you know, the whatever team we should be beating? And in fact, it's taken an emotional manager to make them into this really cool, consistent, relentless machine again, which is just, yeah, that's been the surprising thing. And I guess that is probably down to the fact that he listens to so many people and gets such good advice, and it's a massive team effort, and it's not just about him being this, you know, very charismatic, emotional manager. It's about more than that, obviously.
I don't know if you can teach good management, or it's just a natural thing, Andy, and you've probably spent more time talking to Jurgen Klopp than any of us, but he seems to have that power to just carry everyone with him, and I don't know if that is just innate in certain people.
He does, and I think he's done it wherever he's been too. I mean, it's obviously he's the perfect fit for Liverpool, but I think at all his clubs, everybody has bought into what he wants and what he does. I think the other thing is about him and his personality is it kind of, he's just sometimes seen as a cheerleading figure. And I think, you know, and he's asked about, you know, every issue of the day, whether it's, you know, politics or football or what's going on around the world. But when he gets talking about tactics as well, you know, you could listen to him all day. I think one of the probably problems in our industry a little bit is if you know, you go back to the, and you say, well, I've got Klopp talking about, you know, how he set up the defence thing. But you'd rather go for, you know, the newspaper industry would rather go and listen for the headlines and the grabby intros and that type of thing. But when Klopp is talking tactically, which he does now and again, he's you know, a fascinating, even more fascinating man. And, you know, the amount of work he puts in on the training ground, I mean, he still takes every training session at Liverpool, you know, and I think that sometimes perhaps his charismatic personality, in a way, it takes away from that a little bit, in that he's not given the credit for it.
Yeah, and the thing is, Andy, that listening to people talk about tactics can be quite dull sometimes, but he, during the World Cup some years ago when Germany got to the semi-final, he worked on the German channel TMZ and became renowned for the way in which he was able to explain quite complicated stuff to the layman viewer in very simple and entertaining terms. And I would imagine there are probably footballers who don't particularly like listening to tactical discussions or tactical instruction and find them boring. But his ability to make it very simple, I would imagine, plays a very big part in his success.
I think that he also has this balance, which I imagine is really, really difficult to strike, between excellence and going out there and winning at all costs, and his players giving absolutely everything in every single training session and every single match, with the notion that football isn't everything in the world. And I think he has that kind of personable approach where, you know, he does admit that sometimes there are things that are bigger than football. And I think that really helps him probably to get the best out of his players, because he's got that empathy and understanding of, yes, this is everything right now and in this moment, and this is your job, and we will do our jobs to the absolute best of our ability, but your family is also really important, and the city is really important, and the, you know, the fans, and I think we see that through him. Every time he is asked about the world and something broader than football, you can see that in him, and I think that is a really difficult balance to strike.
I remember when he was really struggling at Dortmund, and they were close to the relegation zone in that final season, and he was constantly being asked about, you know, is this affecting you? And every time he'd say, it affects me when I'm doing my job at the club. But as soon as I go home, I can switch off from it, and I'm not thinking about it. And this is not something you usually hear from managers when they're in a relegation dogfight. It does seem that he's very good at putting them in two compartments, and that probably allows him to do his job better because he doesn't take it home with him.
I always go back to, you know, when he was 20 years old, you know, he'd become a father for the first time. He was going to university to do a sports science business degree. At night, he was working in a warehouse. He was trying to make it as a professional footballer. And I think that, I think that period must have, you know, had a lasting and profound effect on him. And I think that's given him perhaps a bit of a better appreciation that, you know, it's not the be all and end all.
And have you met anyone who doesn't like him?
No.
Yeah.
No.
And that in football, I mean, that in football is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, like, everyone in the game has someone who has, you know, has got a bad word somewhere to say about someone. I think that speaks absolute volumes. And also, like, his ability to take the players with him who aren't playing, right? And that is always a problem in football squads, and it just doesn't seem to be a problem there. I think, Andy, you wrote about, you know, Adam Lallana playing in a cup game, and Lallana sort of barely played this season, and a lot of experienced players have been like, what, you're putting me with the kids to sort of take them through? But he did it presumably for Klopp, right?
I think he's kept everybody on side. He's made everyone feel that they're part of this. Whether, you know, if you look, I mean, he doesn't really change his starting to 11 that often. I mean, he rotates a little bit in midfield, and he'll change defensively, if, you know, mainly because of injuries. But he has his recognisable 11, but everybody has been made to feel part of it. And you don't get players coming out saying, I need to leave because I'm not playing. I mean, they might be thinking that, but they don't come out and say it.
Andy, is that something to do you think, with the vetting process of the players before they come now? Because I know, obviously, he inherited the squad when he first came in, and he had to go through the players and look at those he thought fitted and those who didn't. And obviously, there's a thing with Sacco, who at the time was, you know, one of Liverpool's best defenders, but he got shut of him because he didn't like his attitude. So is that to do with like just making sure that the players who are coming buy into the club, and therefore he knows in advance he might not have that much trouble with them?
Yeah, I think Michael Edwards' role can't be, you know, overlooked in any of this. I think, you know, the research, the background research that he does into the characters of players and his scouting team as well, it is pretty immense. I think and personality, character is a huge part of their transfer process. It's not just, you know, he's the right player for this position or anything like that. They do their homework properly, and I think, you know, it's paid off. You haven't got... For a club of Liverpool's stature and the scrutiny that's on them, you get very little controversy coming out of that dressing room. And it's, you know, I think it's well policed as well internally by Jordan Henderson, James Milner, Van Dijk and Wijnaldum. They're kind of the, you know, one captain and the unofficial captains or the vice captains, if you like. And they police that dressing room really well. And Klopp kind of lets them get on with it.
Andy, just explain who Michael Edwards is and what his story is.
He's the sporting director now, and he came through from reserve right back at Peterborough, but then he was involved in Prozone at its early stages, and then he was taken to Spurs by Harry Redknapp, and then Damien Comoli, when he went from Spurs to Liverpool, he brought Michael Edwards with him, and his influence is basically... just increased during FSG's time there, basically. And he's been promoted up. Him, FSG President Mike Gordon and Klopp, they're the three main men running the operation, basically. And he's basically reorganised the scouting network of Liverpool. He identifies or does the homework on the signings, of which there haven't been that many of late, let's be honest. And yeah, and he and Klopp, you know, thick as thieves as well. He and Michael Edwards and Brendan Rodgers never saw eye to eye, and I think that resulted in a lot of poor signings and, you know, the criticism of the so-called transfer committee. But, you know, Klopp was used to working with a sporting director in Germany, and I think, you know, he and Edwards, you know, as I say, like-minded. Michael Edwards is quite a forthright character, even though he's got a very non-existent public profile. He's very opinionated, and he's not shy to tell Klopp if he thinks he's wrong or he disagrees with him. But they work together brilliantly.
You listen to Guardian Football Weekly, talking about Liverpool winning the title. Back in just a second. We'll begin by asking if any of Liverpool's players are any good. Part two of the Guardian Football Weekly with Andy Hunter, Guardian Merseyside correspondent, Salon Andy Hickman from Football Beyond Borders, and Greg Bukowski, me and Barry as well. Andy, you gave in your sort of player review of this season, you gave 10s to Van Dijk and Mane, 9s to Alisson, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Robertson, Henderson, Salah and Firmino. Oh, they had quite a good season, all of them, didn't you? Didn't they? Graham says, who's the pod's Liverpool player of the year and why? Salon.
I find this really, really difficult, because every single one of them has had a tremendous season. But for me, I think I have to say Virgil van Dijk. And I think it's because, I guess, again, it comes back to me being a younger fan and growing up in an age of Liverpool just need to sort their defence out. Liverpool will never win anything until the defence is sorted out. I loved Sami Hupier as a kid and Jamie Carragher, and I just hadn't seen that kind of player for a long time, and then Virgil van Dijk came along, who is probably one of the best centre-backs football's ever seen, and I think this season particularly, I think because his role is, he brings something to the back line which is bigger than himself and his attributes. It's more that he provides this level of certainty and assurance that allows the other players to kind of have that confidence and freedom, and it allows, you know, Trent and Robbo to bomb up the pitch, because you've got this trust that, you know, the best centre-back in the world is back there. And you know, there were moments this season where you can just see it in his face, which, like, a bit of disappointment when we don't perform to the standard that he expects. And he just has this commanding air about him that makes people around him want to play to the best of their ability. And I think that cannot be overlooked for our success this season.
Henderson for me. I think from where he came as a player when he joined the club to where he is now as a European Cup and English champion, I think he's just been fantastic this season in that he's played in so many different positions as well. And what I mentioned before about when Fabinho got injured, Henderson just slotted into that role. And I would say Liverpool almost played better when he went into Fabinho's role. There's been times when he's had to play on right fullback. I remember he put a fantastic cross in against City in the 3-1 win for the third goal. And he's played at centre-back in the Club World Cup. And as Andy said before, I mean, Klopp delegates an awful lot of you know, he's a very good man manager, but he delegates a lot of that to the captain and to the senior players. And I think Henderson is obviously doing such a good job behind the scenes in keeping everybody happy there. And that comes through on the pitch when, you know, in games when, you know, it looked like Liverpool were in trouble, such as when they were trailing at Villa. I just think he's the player who just keeps everybody going. And he's just been fantastic this season, and amongst so many other great performers at the club.
Andy, I'd wonder, is there a sort of unsung hero that, I mean, it's kind of every week on the pod you go, well, Liverpool were good, who should we talk about this week? Because they're all really good. But I wonder if there's someone, if you're at the game, you see the shape of the game slightly differently to people who are watching on TV. Is there anyone that you go, actually, no one's spotted X yet? I mean, we've all spotted all of them, but I hope you understand the question.
I don't know. There's an unsung hero when a team's won the Champions League, the Club World Cup and the Premier League in 13 months. I think it's all been recognised. One thing I would say, I agree. I think Van Dijk is just unbelievable on another level. And I was in the very strange and privileged position to be going to football matches at the moment. One thing that struck me about it is that he doesn't shut up in a game. I know the centre half should be the one, you know, coaxing everyone, organising everyone, but I noticed in the derby, he just did not shut up. And I also noticed Klopp did not stop having a go at the assistants either. but yeah, that was one little thing that struck me about him is, you know, he basically organised the entire team during that, not just the defence around him. He was, you know, he's bellowing instructions to Mane and Firmino throughout the game. Just one of those little things that perhaps, you know, you see in these strange times that you don't really pick up otherwise.
I mean, you could make a case for nearly every one of the starting 11 for being the player of the season. And in terms of an unsung hero, he's not really unsung, but I'm a huge fan of Andy Robertson. I mean, 8 years ago, he was playing up in Scotland at not a very high level. He famously tweeted about how horrible it was being skint and said he was looking for a job, you know, a proper job, as opposed to working as a lowly paid footballer in the Scottish Highlands. I can't remember where he was, and then when Liverpool signed him for Hull for a pittance, everyone thought they were mad, and he disappeared from view for months, and we all kind of forgot about him. And then his emergence as this absolutely brilliant fullback, and you know, consistently brilliant. He rarely has a bad game. Has been incredible, just in terms of from where he came, and he also seems just like an absolutely top bloke. And you know, at the celebrations the other night, he was pissed out of his head. He looks like a guy who just cannot believe his luck that he's ended up in this team winning Champions Leagues and league titles and World Club Championships. It's been a remarkable journey for him.
Yeah, I mean, they're likeable. I mean, it's hard to be successful and popular. I mean, not that I would know, but I...
I'm glad you got in there first, Matt.
But they are, aren't they? Maybe if they win the league 6 years in a row, we'll get bored of them and start to hate them. But right now, I don't think neutrals dislike Liverpool. I think they're sort of pleased that they won it. Obviously, you want a tighter title race.
They dislike Liverpool fans, I'd say. I think Liverpool fans get the brunt of it. You know, we get the, from every other fan of every other club, is, oh, Liverpool can't win the league because they're going to be insufferable. I hate Liverpool fans. But I think the players have got the love of the Premier League fans.
There's a lot of, they just seem like nice people behind, you know, the personalities and the backstories as well. You know, like Mane really just seems such a humble fella who basically is funding, you know, his own village and putting an infrastructure in back home in Africa. And then Robertson, the work he does for food banks, Salah seems to convey a strong message back home in Egypt. And and Trent Alexander-Arnold, again, you know, seems to be a really humble fella who does a lot for the local community. So yeah, there's not much you could dig around to find that you dislike.
I would say the one thing that makes this title win not as sweet for me personally is the underfunding of Liverpool women. I know what it's like to be in a club where everything is about the men. A lot of these players will have so much love for that club and the badge, the women, and it'll be a bittersweet feeling for them over the last few days, because for those who aren't aware, Liverpool have been relegated from the WSL. They've had kind of chronic underfunding, and when you compare them to their comparative clubs of Chelsea and Man City and the investment that those women's teams have seen from the male counterpart of the club, it's shocking. And now they're going to be a second tier team when the men's team have global success and are probably the best team in the world right now.
Salaam, would you like Klopp to come and say something about that? You sort of feel he's a guy with a social conscience. We've talked about how nice these players are. Like, the men's team could really affect this, I think.
Yeah, and Susie Rack opened her piece a while ago in The Guardian, talking about Klopp looking down the camera and saying, pack out the Merseyside derby, the women's Merseyside derby, you should all go and see it. And that sort of symbol of support is nothing more than a symbol, because it's just, it doesn't mean anything until there's the financial backing, and until there's, we talk about this one club and we talk about the whole this means more and how important football is to this city, but football is important to this city if you're a man. There are so many women in the city who love the club there's such a big fan base there. Why hasn't it been mobilised to support the women's team?
And it wouldn't cost much, would it? I mean,
no. The one thing I'd say is that I think if you look at the two teams in the Women's Super League who have had the most backing from the club, they were both Nike teams, Chelsea and Man City, and Spurs, sorry. And they're the kind of teams you've seen the most investment in. So I'm hoping, I don't know anything, but I am hoping that with the new kit sponsor that we'll see more investment. But that's a bit of a shame as well that it's not been prioritised, and we have to wait till we get a new deal with a new sponsor.
Question from Greg.
Do you think it possibly needs like Spirit of Shankly supporters group, which obviously speak up and say an awful lot about things that are wrong when there's a decision made for the men's team, which, you know, is something they're not into, such as furloughing the staff, the ticket price rises back in 2016, I think it was. And on both those occasions, FSG backed down and did act. And I just wonder if it's actually, because Liverpool as a club is energised by the fans, that fans of the men's team really need to try and get behind the women's team to change things.
Absolutely. And I think those two decisions that you reference were moral decisions, right? And it was moral pressure from the fans, and which is so important to your identity as a Liverpool fan. The pressure from Spirit of Shankly reversed the financial incentive for the club to make those decisions anyway. So you can't even make the argument with, well, it's not financially profitable. If you look at Chelsea and Man City and Spurs and the investment that they've put into their women's side, it can be profitable. So I think you're absolutely right. If Spirit of Shankly put pressure on the club, I think it could go a long way in giving Liverpool women the support they deserve.
Talking about investment, Neil says, where does the men's squad need strengthening?
I think centre-back and midfield. I think potentially Liverpool have got the right players to address what needs addressing there in Naby Keita and Joe Gomez. But injuries are certainly holding Gomez back from having a consistent season. They've interrupted Keita's time at Liverpool from day one. I think as well, when Keita's had his little chances, he hasn't really, he's offered only little glimpses of, you know, the kind of the penetration and the goals perhaps and the creativity that, you know, that Liverpool midfield could sometimes do with. But he doesn't do it consistently enough. And as I say, injuries has been part of the problem. So he is that type that the midfield could do with. And I think as well, when Joe Gomez gets his run and when he's fit, he's a perfect partner for Van Dijk, as is Matip. I really like Matip, to be honest. But again, he's in the similar boat to Gomez in that, you know, he's, you know, seems to be quite brittle. I mean, I thought, you know, like last season, the Champions League final, I thought Matip was outstanding. And I thought he brought that into the start of this season. And then he gets injured again. He's out for several months.
It's I think the difficulty is finding players who will come and be willing to work their way into that first 11. And you know, maybe that was a problem with Timo Werner, I don't know. But there's certain players who will have an expectation to start, and there's some who will, you know, be able to come and improve the game so they could try and work their way into the team. And I think so in the front, you look at the front three, how do you improve on that? You maybe try and get a player who's perhaps better than Origi, but not as good as them, but perhaps could be. So, you know, people have talked about Adama Traore. I'm not sure he necessarily fits because he gets lots of crosses into the box, which Liverpool don't tend to do. Although Klopp would probably work with a player like that and try to improve him and say, well, you could be as good as them, if not better.
I mean, it was interesting last week. It came out again that Liverpool have spent more on agents for the second year running. And they've only bought one outfield player in the last three transfer windows. I think that's quite revealing in itself. I mean, it shows that inside the club, they feel they've got everyone that they need right now anyway. So they're investing on keeping what they have. So, you know, they end up spending £30 million on agent fees last year. And that's to keep what you've got.
And Klopp said as much on Saturday when he had an interview with Bild. He said that, you know, his goal is just to keep this team together because he's had it together for 2.5 years and you see what it's done. And when he won back-to-back titles at Dortmund, he just kept losing players every season to Bayern.
Lots of people have tried to make comparisons between this side and previous Liverpool sides and this season and other great Premier League seasons. I mean, if you look at what they're on for, you know, they've got a 23-point lead. The biggest ever is 19. That was Man City in 17-18. They need 14 from possible 21 points to match City's 100 points. If they win 4 from 7, they equal City's number of wins from 17, 18 and 18, 19. Away wins, they can match City's 16. Home wins, no side has ever won every home game in the Premier League. Is it worth, Greg, comparing this Liverpool side to previous ones yet?
Yeah, probably, because I think you look at last season, they didn't win the league, but they got a bigger points total than any other Liverpool team. So just comparing them in terms of where they were and getting points on the board, they've been incredible. And they won a European Cup and lost in a European Cup final before that. So there already has been three seasons of pretty great football. In terms of how they play and how fluent they are and seeming like they're above other Liverpool teams in terms of their style, or above other teams in the league that they're up against. I'd say the 87-88 Liverpool team, the way they played with Barnes and Beardsley and Aldridge, just how fluid the passing was up front compared to the teams that were around them at the time. This one comes, you know, can be compared, and it's very difficult because that was so long ago. But yeah, they seem so advanced in the way they're playing at the moment.
And Solon, do you envisage years of dominance? I mean, I think next season will be tougher, and I think City, Chelsea, even Man United, might not challenge, but will be much better than they've been this season.
I think it goes back to what we were talking about at the start around how this season was a perfect recipe and there seems to be everyone's in the right positions. So it's not like you can allocate this season to one individual player's brilliance or Klopp just being really charismatic or, you know, other teams not performing as well as they should have, because City have been obviously not as good as they were last season, but they've still been very, very good. And it just feels like because everything's there, it feels like it's there for a long time. And that everything being in place to kind of create and continue the success is what I think gives me the optimism and the hope that this is a period of dominance rather than a one-off.
Now, Barry, you noticed, you know, a month or so ago, a lot of journalists wrote opinion pieces about how outrageous it was to suggest that some Liverpool fans may go outside and celebrate. And it turned out some Liverpool fans did go out and celebrate.
Yeah, and it didn't surprise me at all. I mean, I don't blame them for going out celebrating. And Tony Evans of The Independent, who is obviously a Liverpool fan as well, a well-known Liverpool fan, he got quite cross with me on Friday night on Twitter. I just asked him what had made him so confident that Liverpool fans wouldn't go out and celebrate. And his argument is that a lot has changed since all those opinion pieces, you know, of indignant opinion pieces came out, and the Dominic Cummings effect, which I suppose is fair enough, but a lot was always going to have to change for football to be played anyway. So the lockdown rules were obviously going to have to be loosened a little. My big problem is that people like Tony, I don't really know Tony, I've met him, but a lot of people I know hold him in extremely high regard, and I'm told he's an absolutely top bloke, and I've no reason not to believe that. But he and others, I hasten to add, Spirit of Shankly were mentioned earlier, they were also incredibly indignant when Mayor Joe Anderson of Liverpool suggested that it was a bad idea to restart the league just because this would happen. They constantly make the distinction between football fans and, say, people going to the beach without realising that lots of people who like football also like going to the beach. The intersection of that Venn diagram is huge. We're not having a go at football fans. It's just people. It's human nature to want to go and celebrate with like-minded individuals if your team has won the title for the first time in 30 years. It's human nature to want to go to the beach and have a nice day if the sun is out, because we don't get too many days of sunshine here. So I think people like me who saw this coming, I'm not having a go at football fans. It's a people thing. The club condemned the behaviour. Spirit of Shankly put out a pretty disappointing statement in the aftermath, in which they sort of just stated what had happened but didn't condemn it in any way. But, you know, I would imagine a lot who were out celebrating on Thursday and Friday night, many of them may never have set foot in Anfield. You know, it's not a specific football fan problem.
Don't you think there's a difference, though, between Thursday and Friday? I think Thursday was an emotional outpouring, and like the feelings I had in just, I had to get out the house, I had to be with people, was I felt like, I don't know, I was on a drug or something. But I didn't really feel like that on Friday. And I think those who were out on Friday, that was just dickhead behaviour, and you call it out when there's dickhead behaviour. And, you know, I don't think that was, you know, get out your system on the Thursday night, but realise there's a pandemic. That's just a sensible thing.
Well, what I would say as well is, I mean, you know, Friday night, we're not just talking about someone setting off a firework at the Liver building. Police were getting pelted with bottles by the end of the night, and there was fights on the Strand in Liverpool with police in riot gear. I mean, and, you know, the statements that came from Liverpool didn't condemn behaviour. They condemned people not observing social distancing rules. There's been no condemnation of that behaviour, and the Spirit of Shankly statement wasn't really worth the effort of writing it. It was pathetic. And I think some of the journalists have tried to make excuses for it as well, which is also absolutely embarrassing.
The Spirit of Shankly state, they were absolutely outraged when Joe Anderson suggested fans might congregate outside Anfield. Their outrage when he suggested this was incredible. And then when he was proved right, that more or less silence.
The hysteria was so mad on Thursday night, I ended up getting a homemade tattoo.
I saw that. Tattoo. What is it? Is it Jurgen Klopp's face?
Is it something you can show us?
It's on my foot. Hang on. It's terrible. So it's supposed to be the olive branch that the liver bird has out in its mouth.
Oh, okay.
But I drew it on with a biro, a homemade kit, ink kit, a stick and poke for about 30 minutes going over it. And it doesn't look like it's going to rub off, I'm afraid.
So sorry, I've got so many questions here. So it's not a permanent, you don't have like a tattoo parlor in your house?
No, it's a permanent tattoo.
It's a permanent tattoo.
So it's a stick and poke kit is basically where you do, how you do homemade tattoos. Right. So it's just a needle and the ink.
And it's
sterile. This sounds very prison.
Well, it's not like, you know, an outpouring of emotion like Tardelli, right? Is, you know, it's 30 seconds of, oh my God, you know, half an hour of pain. Do you know, halfway through, think the moment's sort of gone here?
Yeah, it was, you know, 30 minutes, a minute for each year of not winning it, basically.
I feel like my celebrations are a bit low key now. I should have been opening myself up and stitching myself back up or something.
Would it be fair to say, Ceylon, that drink had been taken when you got this tattoo?
Yeah, drink's been consumed all weekend. This is the first time of being sober for a while.
All right, that'll do for part two. Greg, we've got to let you go now. Have a lovely day. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Max.
No worries. And we'll be back in just a sec. Look at the FA Cup quarterfinals. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the FA Cup semi-final draw, Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal, Man City. The match is all won by the away team. Manchester United won at Norwich. Barry, Harry Maguire ruining the chance of all of us to see Tim Krul being a massive shithouse in another penalty shootout. I was livid with him on Saturday night.
Yeah, I was really angry because I sat through all of that game. It wasn't a good game of football. In fact, I would venture to say it's one of the worst I've ever seen, or certainly that I can remember off the top of my head. And penalties was the one thing that was keeping me going. So, sod you, Harry. Very disappointing. And Tim Krul, you'd always back him in a shootout, and I think he's saved two penalties in games against Manchester United this season already. So probably relief for United, because they may well have lost if it had gone to penalties.
Odion Ighalo scored, and a lot of us laughed when he was signed by Manchester United as a sign of their, you know, terminal decline. But actually, he's been quite shrewd business. Ceylon, as a Liverpool fan, would you be happy to see United win the FA Cup in a kind of... It's got to the stage now where you can pity them, or is that going a step too far?
I think I am at a point where I don't really mind what happens now. And I think Marcus Rashford and the Free School Meals campaign has given me another big soft spot for United, the first being that Chris Smalling obviously does a lot with the charity that I work for. Mm-hmm. So my dad's not happy. My mum actually texted me last night to say, she was a teacher, and she texted me last night to say, I think I've probably chosen the wrong time to come out to dad that I actually really like Manchester United because of Marcus Rashford, even though she's a massive Liverpool fan. So yeah, they can do it. You know, I wish them well.
It's got to that stage now. That's a nice place to be, isn't it? Simon says, serious question alert, probably one for Barry. I noticed during the Norwich-Manchester United game that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer appears to be thinning quite a lot on top. At what stage of balding do we no longer refer to him as a baby-faced assassin?
I hadn't noticed that. But, I mean, the more bald he gets, the more baby-faced he'll be, surely, because most babies don't have much hair or any hair. So I think we can call him that for the foreseeable future. I almost said going forward there, which is an expression I hate, but I stopped myself at the last second.
Chelsea won 1-0 at Leicester. Lovely finish from Ross Barkley. I mean, this game, of all the games where you think these players look really tired, it looked like every pass was misplaced. You know, someone would give it away and then the other team would just give it away again. We on the pod have been very critical of Frank Lampard, as we have with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I mean, Jonathan Wilson's been very critical of Lampard. Andy, were we wrong all the time? What do we think?
Yeah, I think it's too soon to judge him, really. He's only, you know, 1 year as Chelsea manager, and I think, you know, if he gets a Champions League qualification and wins the FA Cup, then it's a fine start. And I think, you know, he's got a clear idea of what he wants for next season as well, in terms of the speed and the type of player they're going for now. So, no, I think he's made a really good, a better start than I was expecting, to be honest, because I didn't think, you know, he did a decent enough job at Derby, but I didn't think it was enough to qualify him for what Chelsea were aiming for. But, you know, I think he's well on course for that at the minute, and showed that they were right to appoint him.
And actually, those signings, you know, Werner and Hakim Ziyech as well, are both brilliant players, and fascinating to see how they will fit into Chelsea's side. Arsenal won 2-1 at Sheffield United. Two wins now in two. At Southampton in the league on Thursday night as well. I expected, Barry, some sort of complete crisis, you know, but actually sort of, you've got to give them some credit for digging in a bit there.
Yeah, I suppose you do. The one caveat I'd add is that neither of their wins were particularly convincing, so I wouldn't get too excited about those victories. But, you know, it's better than not winning, isn't it?
We were talking about nice fullbacks, Scottish left-backs and Andy Robertson. It's great to see Kieran Tierney turn up with his stuff in a Tesco bag. and I don't think it was even a bag for life. It was just a, you know, it was a proper 5p job. It just made me incredibly happy. Man City won at Newcastle. De Bruyne and Sterling with the goals for them. Who do you think is going to win the FA Cup, Ceylon?
I haven't even thought about it, you know, Max. It's out of my sphere of interest now, to be honest. Now, I could give you an answer, but I don't really care.
I would say an FA Cup final behind closed doors is no FA Cup final at all. It fills me with dread, the prospect of... See, I mean, the four teams in the semi-final, I think, have won the last six cup finals between them. So it's not a particularly exciting year for the competition, and the fact that the final will be played behind closed doors is disappointing. If I could touch briefly on the City Newcastle game, I've been very critical of Newcastle fans who are slow to give Steve Bruce credit for anything, but after that performance I can kind of come around to maybe their way of thinking, because it was a very insipid display. They let City have the ball, they didn't have a go at all. I think they'd one good chance which Dwight Gayle blazed over the bar.
I mean, it was more than a good chance though, Barry.
Oh yeah. It was edge of the 6-yard box, ball on a plate, and it was easier to score. But if you're gonna lose a quarter, and Newcastle, you know, cup run means everything to them. If you're gonna lose 2-0, you might as well lose 8-0, you know, just have a go at least. I was disappointed by that.
I would go for City for the FA Cup, but the strange thing is, so if this season finishes and City have won the FA Cup and the League Cup, have they had a good season if they don't win the Champions League and they're that far behind Liverpool, haven't had, you know, 8 defeats so far? I don't think they have.
You don't?
I think they've got away with it.
I mean, 2 trophies, is 2 out of 4 is not bad, is it? I see your point. It's interesting. And actually, we didn't really, you know, we talked a lot about how good Liverpool have been. And you know, one of the big differences between this season and last season is last season, City and Liverpool were both brilliant. And this season, City haven't been. And they've, you know, lost 8 games, which is quite extraordinary. And they've had injury problems, I guess, as well. I think if you get 2 out of 4, it's okay, isn't it?
I think everyone would usually bite your hands off for that. But I just think with, you know, where City are at and their investment and what Guardiola's capable of, I don't think that would satisfy him anyway.
Sandy says, why Wembley for these semi-finals? I reckon they should be played at the most centrally located venue. As the crow flies, United-Chelsea should be at Nuneaton Borough and Arsenal City should be at Hinckley United. Thank you, Sandy. We'll see what we can do. In the Premier League...
I mean, they might as well play them at Nuneaton Borough and Hinckley United. Why not?
Yeah, that's not a terrible idea. In the Premier League, Watford played Southampton. They both lost last Thursday. Southampton won 3-1. Watford really in trouble. Danny Ings brilliant again for Southampton. I presumed, Ceylon, that Watford would just be fine. You know, Nigel Pearson would just be solid enough. But it's very hard to pick out of them. And Villa lost as well. It's so hard to pick out of those four, isn't it? Villa, Watford, Bournemouth and... West Ham, that's who I've forgotten.
I mean, Watford can have a bit of history this season by being the only team to have beat Liverpool. So does that count as a good season for Watford?
You know, when you said Liverpool fans are insufferable, and I sort of don't buy into that, but you know, as you just say, yeah, Man United can have the FA Cup, I don't mind. Watford, hey, you beat Liverpool, you can get relegated, it's fine.
I'm looking forward to the tweets that I'm going to receive.
What's your Twitter? Give your Twitter handle, Ceylon.
At Ceylon Andy. There you go.
Right. I was just looking. The bottom 5 teams in the Premier League have played 13 games since restart, and between them, 0 wins, 3 draws, and 10 defeats. So I think Watford may stay up, mainly due to the ineptitude of those beneath them. But obviously the big story there is about Andre Gray's birthday party, which his Surrey mansion, with where he lives with one of the young ladies from Little Mix. He had a birthday party, I think, on Friday, 20 people around, game of five aside, and it led to him, Nathaniel Chalabah and Dominguez Kina being left out of their squad for the game. And that just shows a remarkable lack of common sense on his part. And Andre Gray gave a brilliant interview to The Guardian recently, in which he came across as a very intelligent, thoughtful, well-educated guy. And then to go and do this when his team are in a relegation battle just smacks of total lack of care, really. It's almost as if he isn't bothered about staying up or not.
Also, you know, might have affected the other Watford players who were feeling sad that they weren't invited to his party. You know, did Craig Cathcart, Jose Holobas feel a bit, you know? And you, now with social media, you can see a party's happening. They could see all the fun that's happening, but not be invited.
Well, as someone who's been the victim of a high-profile snub from someone who I thought was a friend that didn't invite me to his wedding, Max, I feel Craig Cathcart and Troy Deeney's pain.
Barry, we've been through this.
We've been through it twice in the last 24 hours.
And I'll happily say it again. Solon and Andy can be the judge because they don't know the story. I had a wedding, just family, literally just family. All right, no friends invited. A year later, I had a big party, band, food, catered venue, everything paid for, invited all my closest people. I got a text 2 days before from someone saying, I'm not coming, it's not really my thing. Who out of those two would you say is in the wrong?
I think there's a case to be made that Barry was so upset that he wasn't considered family of yours after all this time.
Yeah.
That a year later, he was still hung up on it.
I do spend more time with you than the woman you married, Matt.
Yes, and I find it very disappointing, to be honest. My whole life is looking at you in a Zoom screen.
In the very unlikely
invited,
event.
You've got to go. You've got to go if you're invited.
Exactly.
Even if
right.
you like, even if you don't like the fella, yeah. You've got to go.
Thank you, Andy.
I literally wouldn't have known anyone in the room. So
it's not about you, Barry, is it? It's not about you. Literally not about you.
Well, just know this, Max, yeah. That in the very unlikely event that I ever get married, you'd be on the shortlist for best man. Oh, so I hope you feel suitably guilty.
Leeds now have a 9-point cushion between themselves and third place after a dominant 3-0 win over Fulham. Pablo Hernandez's pass for the third goal was just a thing of absolute beauty. And I'm a big fan of Pablo Hernandez, also because he sort of looks a bit like he's just stumbled out of a nightclub and ended up on the pitch, but he's a man of immense talent. Brentford beat West Brom on Friday night, so Brentford just 5 points behind Slaven Bilic's side. Neil Warnock won his first game in charge at Middlesbrough away at Stoke.
Of course he did.
And the opening goal was from a set piece, of course. So well done, Neil. A bit of Europe for you. We'll hopefully talk to Archie on Thursday, but the Bundesliga is over. Bayern Munich round off their season, beating Wolfsburg 4-0. They scored 100 goals, only the second side in Bundesliga history to do that. Former Leicester striker Andre Kramaric scored all four as Hoffenheim beat runners-up Borussia Dortmund. Mönchengladbach are into the Champions League. Werder Bremen are in the relegation playoff position. Do you think we should have a relegation playoff position in the Premier League? I'd be a big fan of, you know, 17th place having to drop in and play with the Championship teams.
Yeah, I'd be up for it. I mean, would that be instead of or as well as playoffs? I'd rather playoffs.
Oh, I think you have playoffs, but I think you include someone from the Premier League as well, just for a bit more jeopardy.
I think getting 14 clubs to vote for that might be tricky.
But in Bundesliga 2, Hamburg needed just a point to play Bremen in that playoff, and they lost 5-1 to mid-table Sandhausen. In Spain, Barca were held at Celta Vigo. Iago Aspas scoring a late equaliser for Celta. Aspas took off his shirt after scoring. He was accidentally shown a red card by the referee and was quite baffled by it. And then the referee realised his mistake and changed it back. Real extended their lead with a 1-0 win over Espanyol. In Italy, Juve are 4 points clear of Lazio. They won 4-0 on Friday night against Lecce, which is a lovely spot for a mini break. And now we should talk about Arjen Robben, shouldn't we? He's announced his plans to come back to Groningen after 18 years after he left them. Isn't that a lovely, that's a lovely story. Finally can go back and cut inside for his first ever club.
I like that. It's like where Dirk Kuyt went back to Feyenoord, didn't he, just to, you know, wrap things up neatly. I think that's the way it should be done. A nice circle.
Daniel Agger.
Yeah, I like that.
He went back.
Well, every footballer should bookend their professional career.
Yeah, no, but back to amateur days too as well.
I think I feel Damien Duff went back to Shamrock Rovers as well, I think. I don't think he played for them very often because being Damien Duff, he was injured. But yeah, it is a nice little touch.
Solon, you wanted to talk about the scenes in the US yesterday from the NWSL Challenge Cup.
Yes, in the Chicago Red Stars versus Washington Spirits game, there was a really powerful demonstration against police brutality and systemic racism as part of the Black Lives Matter movement that we've seen with Casey Short and Julie Ertz both taking the knee, and Casey Short in real visible distress and a really emotional scene to watch as a black woman was sobbing during the national anthem on one knee and was being supported by her white teammate Julie Ertz. And I think, yeah, seeing those scenes, I think, you know, I don't want to get to a point where, because we're seeing so many players across all of our leagues taking the knee at the moment, that it becomes kind of normalised and you kind of might lose the significance of the gesture and its history and its origins. And I think, seeing that moment and the raw emotion, how much this means and how awful it must be to be a black person in the US, really demonstrated the power of that gesture. And in a week where, you know, you've got Dominic Raab saying, "Oh, I think it's, you know, about subjugation and I don't really understand," and it's a bit Game of Thrones-esque, and that's just so far away from what it means and what this is all about. And I thought, yeah, it was really beautiful to watch, but also there's also a tension around, you know, a black woman's struggle being so visible and you know, visceral and kind of everywhere, all over the news, and that's really that's another experience to be a black person in sport and high profile sport, that, you know, if you're feeling something and it comes out, and then the whole world has to see it as well, and it's kind of maybe a privacy that she wasn't afforded as well. So I just thought it was a really nice moment between the two players, and for it to, yeah, really demonstrate what this is all about for professional athletes and other sports people and black people across the world right now.
Actually, Football Beyond Borders have been talking about this a lot and the Black Lives Matter movement, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think we've had, obviously we work with a lot of young people, and our young people are really angry about the world right now and really upset, and it, you know, some of them are actually really, really exhausted too, because everywhere you look, kind of, you know, I know Marcus was talking about this last week on Thursday, but it must be exhausting right now to be a black person. But yeah, the kind of shows of solidarity. So just important that it stays, right? And this message continues, that we continue to put pressure on the systems and our governments to really, yeah, I guess there's a lot of demands, right? To defund the police, etc. But we maybe don't want to get into that right now at the end of the Guardian Football Weekly.
No, but I would say, not just on this, but throughout lockdown, you know, those the stuff that Football Beyond Borders has been doing on social media has been really important, I think, and getting perspectives of people that don't often have a voice, certainly not voices that, you know, I hear on a daily basis when I'm just sort of wandering about in my day. So they've been really good. Not a question.
Thanks, Max. That's all right. And yeah, if people want to get involved as well, we're actually, you know, it should have been the Euros 2020 right now. Instead of the Euros, we've been running the FPB 2020 challenge. So from the 12th of June, when the tournament would have kicked off, till the 12th of July, we've been challenging everyone to kind of run, walk or cycle a distance, and then donate the same amount to fund our virtual school that allows us to keep working with young people. So we've got a few weeks left. I've got 92 kilometres of running to do before Sunday, the 12th of July, when the final would be. And we've got two guys who are, this is mental, but they're running 200 miles in 24 hours.
Oh no.
Instead of watching the Euros final, and that's Sunday the 12th of July, to raise money for us. So yeah, if you're around and want to socially distance in Bermondsey Park on Sunday the 12th of July, that's where the final is going to be happening.
200 miles
it's mental, isn't it?
That's not healthy. Yeah. not good for you. Yeah. Not good for your ankles. Now, much more importantly, Lars Sivertsen made a terrible mistake on Thursday's pod when he was quoting the line, "Can you ever just be whelmed?" And he said it was from Clueless, and it was actually from 10 Things I Hate About You. Luke 18 below the line says, both 10 Things and Clueless are classics of the genre, but this is not a forgivable mistake. I hope The Guardian acts quickly and ruthlessly. We will, and Lars will never be seen again. And finally, from James, has Barry chosen to be rested for Tuesday's pod? Doesn't matter how many hints I make. Barry, what choice have you made for tomorrow?
I'll be here, Max. I believe we're doing a particularly cerebral one. I'm not sure I'll have much to contribute.
Philippe Auclair and Tarek Panja. Basically, every time Philippe comes on, we give him 2 minutes to rant about FIFA, and then it's all edited out for legal reasons. So I'm going to give him a whole hour to talk about basically whatever he wants, and I'm worried that it'll make you lose all the love for football when you hear about all the things that happen behind the scenes. But you know, you'll be there for your
Guardian legal department is on red alert.
It absolutely is. Anyway,
Tuesday's pod will be about 3 minutes long. It'll be like, "Hello, Philippe. Hello, Tariq. Hello, Barry. We'll be back on Thursday."
With just one line going, they obviously deny all the allegations. Anyway, look, that'll do for today. Salam, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Congratulations. Enjoy your tattoo. Andy Hunter, thank you, mate.
Thanks for having me. Thanks a lot.
No worries. Cheers, Baz.
Cheers.
Thanks for your time, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.